The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today our guest Tom Hudson, as we talked about last week, who is on PBS and speaks about the news every night.
Kevin, it'll be an interesting conversation today. We're looking forward to discussing a whole broad range of issues, whether it's the role of media, the impact of Dodd-Frank, dividend-paying stocks versus the interest rate environment we're in today and tomorrow. I mean, we can go a lot of different places in conversation with Tom. He's used to asking the questions, actually, so our roles are a bit reversed today. Tom, thanks for joining us. Most of our viewers would know you from the PBS Nightly Business Report. And, you know, you are in an interesting position. You're in touch with a broad cross-section of investment analysts and professionals. Rarely do you get to explore issues extensively on air, given the time constraints of programming. It's particularly interesting, with that in mind, for us to get your perspectives on a variety of issues, with time being less of an issue. You sit in a sort of information nexus with access to a broad array of these investment experts. How do you filter the data that you have available to you? What particular matrix, you know, is there, you know, chief influences that you have intellectually which allow you to kind of organize all the data that flows your particular direction?
Yeah, it's a great question, David. And first of all, thank you for the time and the opportunity to talk. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. And I'm certainly humbled and lucky to sit at exactly the unique position which you described, which is a nexus, kind of a crossroads of information coming my way, and my true privilege, really, to present that to people on a national and international basis every night on Nightly Business Report on PBS. One of the things I think that I start with every day is that the market isn't wrong or right, it just is. And price matters, and price action matters. That tells us really what's going on. Everything else, geopolitical talk, politics in Washington, local politics and state capitals, all of that kind of talk is great for flavor and color, but the play-by-play is on the ticker itself. And I usually try to let the market tell me what is going to be most important in terms of price action and in terms of volatility. Those are the places really that I begin every day when I begin to prepare for my program, David, to really let people know what's happened today in the market, and perhaps most importantly and more importantly, begin to let them know about how tomorrow may be shaping up.
Well, it sounds very familiar to Charles Dow, Hamilton, Rhea, and sort of the modern practitioner of Dow theory, Richard Russell, who would say absolutely price action is all that you have to go on. That is the language of the market. Now, if we want to dive in on that particular point, Russell has mentioned recently that should the Dow break below 11,823, that he would consider a confirmation of a long-term bear market, that being sort of the context that we're in. But he's agnostic at this point because we're not there. Again, he's looking at price action and saying, well, we'll have a confirmation of a further downside move. You know, do you look back at history and use some of those kinds of ideas?
I do. I think history obviously is a great guide for what's going to happen in the future. It clearly doesn't have a monopoly on what's happening in the future, but we clearly have to know where we've gone to hopefully get a better idea of where we're going. Now, you know, throughout my career in financial journalism, I'll be honest, I have tried my best and darndest to explain to people why the Dow Jones Industrial Average is probably the least important of the major equity averages and indices to pay attention to. But I'll tell you, I might as well be talking to a brick wall, because people always want to hear about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, always want to measure kind of the mood of the market by using those 30 stocks, even with all the shortcomings of the Dow being it's price-weighted, it's somewhat actively managed, not on a daily basis, but clearly there are stocks that come in and out of that. The Dow 30 today is very far from the Dow 30 that hit the recession low back in 2009, and is still a very different index than hit Dow 14,000 back in the fall of 2007. So it's a much different index today than the one that we're going to be talking about perhaps in the next couple of years, be that either a Dow 11,000 or below or Dow 15,000 or above.
So you're looking for a broader cross-section and something that's perhaps a more adequate sample size.
Exactly. I think a sample size is interesting. And Dow theory is clearly one of those ideas that does come into play in the market, because it is just that. It's a theory, but it's one that has been time-tested, and there's a lot of literature on it and a lot of acceptance of it. But clearly, it's not the only market theory that we have when we prepare our broadcasts every night, nor is it the only market theory that folks use when trying to prepare their portfolios. I think that, getting back to the idea of this nexus of information that I'm able to sit at every day and have the pleasure to take all that information and make it meaningful, accessible, and useful and actionable for people, the Dow is one of those clearly that we always have to watch, probably more out of habit than necessity. But I think the broader, S&P 500 or the Russell 2000 gives us a much clearer picture of really what's going on within the equity markets. But, David, I kind of began my financial journalism career on the derivatives floor and the options exchange in Chicago and the Chicago Merck and the Board of Trade. And that's why I always get back to that price action. I mean, the futures guys and gals that I began covering would always want to look at the book, look at the liquidity, look at the depth of the book, and look at the transparency of the book to really get a feeling for where the market's headed.
Well, then if it's not equities, I mean, obviously that gets the most attention in broadcasting. That's probably where people have most of their money tied up, is equities and to some degree bonds as well. But, today derivatives dwarf the size of the traditional investment markets by a factor of 3 to 5. I mean, if you've got globally roughly $200 trillion worth of paper assets, on the derivative side, you've got somewhere between $600 trillion and, if we can even conceive of the number, a quadrillion.
Right.
You know, one point, I think they said about 1.4 quadrillion, and it's a lot less than that now.
But those are usually nominal figures, and we can explain nominal figures away by, those are the numbers on the papers. Those are, perhaps that all of those things don't wind up with that kind of value out there. But listen, I agree with you, David. I think that, the media pays attention to the equity market in part because there's a physical place for it in lower Manhattan and in midtown Manhattan, both the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. And so that's helpful for a lot of people because we're able to put these concepts into a physical space, into our physical 3D world. Whereas the derivative space, while there's plenty of action on the exchange side derivatives, much of the derivative space, including Forex, is all over the counter. And it gets to be much more conceptual. And quite honestly, concepts are difficult to put on television, David.
Well, does it tell you anything when the side bets, again, coming back to the relative scale of the derivatives market, are far surpassed the underlying assets, both in terms of the revenue importance to, say, an NYSE and foreign exchanges as well? The scale is different. Revenue importance, derivatives are now more important than the underlying assets.
Right. More important in terms of the size, perhaps, but those derivatives clearly wouldn't exist without the underlying asset. I mean, maybe it's a chicken or the egg kind of argument, but the underlying asset clearly has a lot of importance and needs to exist in order for the derivatives markets to exist and flourish like they are. When I would bring visitors into the derivatives exchanges in Chicago where I began, they would look at them and they would say, this is one big loud casino with no slot machines. And I would consistently say, no, the big difference between the derivatives market and a casino is the casino is creating risk where there was none. And the derivatives market is merely pricing risk that already exists and allowing folks to mitigate it, to trade it, to profit, and to lose from it.
Mm-hmm. It brings in certainly the concept of counterparty, because on the other side of every transaction is the assumption that the counterparty can stand up to the requirements to pay.
Yeah.
If you've hedged out the risk and that's been passed on, that person who's accepted it has to be able to maintain liquidity sufficient to pay. Is that kind of the big risk in the derivatives market, is counterparty?
It is over the counter, but it's not when it comes to the exchanges. Think back to the spring of 2008, we had Bear Stearns essentially collapse. And then fast forward from March to September of 2008, we had Lehman Brothers collapse. We had AIG collapse, which was a counterparty risk to some degree. We had a number of investment banks wind up becoming bank holding companies so that they could have access to Fed liquidity so that their capital structures wouldn't collapse under the pressure of counterparty risk. But we didn't have exchanges. Derivative exchanges have those same financial problems because they step in as the intermediary between the buyer and seller to guarantee that the two sides on exchange-traded derivatives that the two sides do have the liquidity and the depth of capital to put up the capital necessary in order to make a transaction complete. And one of the things that we can look at in the derivative space, we need to separate between those derivatives that were contributing to the problems that happened in 07 and 08, which were over-the-counter derivatives, and those that were happening on an exchange, and we didn't have counterparty risk, we didn't have clearing problems. There weren't exchange-traded derivatives in 08 and even 09 at the height of the financial collapse that got busted because the counterparties were unable to fulfill their obligations as long as they were trading on an exchange. The same cannot be said for over-the-counter trading of derivatives, and to some degree that is where regulators ought to be focused in on. And that's why the exchanges really want to grab a lot of that business that's been going on over the counter, bring it on to an exchange, because clearly it's very profitable. And the exchanges will point out that they, acting as an intermediary, as a clearinghouse, can essentially step in and protect from that counterparty risk to which you talk about.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
We've had a gentleman, Richard Buchstaber, on our program a number of times. He wrote a book called The Demon of Our Own Design and has been a part of the risk management infrastructure at groups like Smith Barney and other groups as well in Manhattan. In all the Senate hearings that he's done, that's what he's pointed to, is that regulation should focus on bringing these things onto exchanges. Do you think that has anything to do with this merger between NYSE and the German Börse? And coming back to that idea of the physical space, here in the U.S., we think of the U.S. capital markets as one of the deepest, richest capital markets in the world, and yet we're seeing an icon essentially shift to another continent.
Right, to the Germans. Remember the last time the Germans bought an American icon? Daimler Chrysler. I'll bring you back to that merger of equals in 1998. Let's hope for the shareholders this one doesn't wind up the same way. Listen, I think in terms of the New York Stock Exchange, Eurex, Deutsche Börse deal, while it's not entirely about derivatives, that's a big part of it. The biggest slice of the New York Stock Exchange, Eurex revenue, I believe over 35% comes from derivatives. Maybe 30% comes from trading of equities. So it is as much a derivatives exchange as it is an equities exchange, despite its long, long history as the icon of American equities. And that's what Germans are after, and it's becoming an international market, clearly. The challenge that not only U.S. regulators have, but European regulators and other locations have, is the standardization of derivatives contracts. Now, it may be easy to do that for corn, it may be easy to do that for oil, although we're seeing a little bit of split in terms of the different type of global oil markets between West Texas and Brent and Oman and elsewhere. You know, trying to put a credit default swap or some kind of debt obligation on a standard basis in order for it to get on exchange has been proven very difficult in the U.S., and to do it internationally has been proven thus far pretty near impossible.
Well, we have legislative attempts and regulations which are coming out of Washington, which are supposed to address the problems which caused the financial crisis in the first place. Monumental effort by Dodd and Frank, at least the legislation in their name. I chatted with a gentleman down in the Bahamas, same conference you and I were at, Richard Ron, from the Cato Institute. And you know, he describes Dodd and Frank as fundamentally corrupt. Well, you may not agree with that, but is the legislation, is it actually addressing the issues which played a causal role in the financial crisis? Or do we still have a second shoe to drop, perhaps, because the fundamentals have not really changed?
Well, in terms of the legislation, let me address that first. I think that so much of the legislation has been left to the rulemaking bodies. And what I mean by that is the legislation directs regulators to write rules that are designed to avoid or minimize the buildup of systemic risk. We'll take that as it is. So much of the legislation is going to be written in the regulators' boardrooms and their conference rooms. And I think there, it quite honestly becomes a matter of resources. And we've already seen the new Republican House begin to try to take financial resources or limit the growth of financial resources for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or even the Securities and Exchange Commission that could limit their ability to not only write the hundreds of rules that need to be written under the Dodd-Frank legislation, but then, of course, comes the question of enforcement, should those rules actually be put into place. So I think when it comes to the legislation, whether or not it addresses the systemic issues that came up during the collapse, it is going to be a matter of what the rules are, and then, honestly, the regulators' financial wherewithal to monitor and adjudicate those rules. So I think the final chapter on Dodd-Frank clearly is far from over. And in terms of even the ability to go after the systemic problems, there's lots within Dodd-Frank that doesn't really have to do with derivatives per se. There's some, you know, consumer financial protections and those kinds of things. And it does wind up getting to how much do we want regulators and rules to try to protect financial markets from not only the ability to profit, but the ability to loss. And I think that is a root question that still remains unanswered on the part of regulators and the part of a lot of investors as well.
Well, with a few minutes left to discuss things today, maybe we could talk about interest rates, commodities, oil, quantitative easing 1 and 2, and a few other things. Maybe we can give about 20 seconds to each.
Lots to talk about, certainly.
Starting with the big picture with interest rates, if you step back from the quarter-to-quarter analysis of interest rates and focus on that big picture, I remember Alan Shaw and Louise Yamada doing an extensive study back in 2004 with Smith Barney on the duration of interest rate trends. And it appears from a technical perspective, the downtrend in rates, which began in about 1980, is reversing. The question is this: should interest rates adjust higher? Are corporations geared for a sustained period of higher capital costs?
You know, I think that corporations are clearly preparing for that, and we've seen it throughout the downturn and now the relative upswing that we've seen since the March 09 equity lows. Corporate balance sheets have been increasing. Corporations have been launching stock buyback efforts, and that has clearly an impact on earnings. And you've also seen a lot of corporations begin to, well, continue really, quite frankly, to issue a load of debt, both short-term floating debt, trying to take advantage of maybe some of the variations in interest rates here lately because of quantitative easing and some of the other Federal Reserve programs that have been going on, but also issuing loads and loads of longer-term fixed-rate debt, taking advantage of these low rates. I mean, we've even seen talk finally surface on the largest issuer of debt out there, the U.S. government, talking about a Methuselah bond of sorts to try to take advantage of these low long-term rates, almost in a tacit acknowledgement, David, that, yeah, the cyclical, rather the, you know, generation-long bull market in fixed income is likely over and likely to turn themselves around. I think the capital structure of companies is prepared, at least in the medium term, for that. But we're also seeing, you know, some private companies begin to turn away from the public markets for some reasons, and part of it may be because of the longer-term concern about the cost of that capital in the next several decades.
Yeah, it has been encouraging to see corporations, CEOs, and CFOs get very serious about their maturity structures. The concern that may remain is at the municipal and at the federal level, where our maturity structure is pretty awful.
Yeah.
36 months, 70% of our debt nationally coming due. And, you know, it's a little bit different because we do have a printing press. We can continue to finance ourselves if no one else will. But at the municipal level, that's an interesting issue. You know, we do have debt that's going to be maturing, and the question is how will these individual states and cities cope? Well, moving on to commodities, you know, we had a run from 2001 to 2008. We now have the CCI and CRB again pressing higher. Are we seeing inflation in terms of prices reflecting monetary policy, in your opinion, or are these truly supply and demand dynamics?
Well, I think that when it comes to agricultural commodities, I think when it comes to energy commodities, oil and heating oil, gasoline, we do see supply and demand. And, you know, maybe part of this is my upbringing in the Midwest, just outside the cornfields in Iowa, and then spending a lot of time at the Board of Trade in Chicago and watching how these things are priced on a daily basis. But these are global markets for agriculture commodities. There's no doubt about it, as it is a global market for oil. And we are seeing global demand continue to uptick. We know that emerging market GDP growth is certainly going to outpace global GDP growth, which is certainly going to outpace developed world GDP growth. So demand is there. And the weather has not been behaving too well over the past couple of years in various parts of the world for some of these agriculture commodities. And we haven't seen a whole new swath of oil supply come onto the market, even though inventories are very full in the United States and elsewhere. We're not dealing with a supply issue. It truly is a demand curve. And then I think on the inflation side, you look at the metals, not only just the precious metals, but even industrial metals, you do have a sense of concern about longer-term global inflation, in part fed by the Federal Reserve, but also in part fed by other central banks in Europe and elsewhere that have, and even in China to some degree, that have provided cheap money to help either keep their economies invigorated or try to re-spark an economic boom like we're trying to do in the Western world. But, you know, I think when it comes to the inflation side of thing, we also have to keep in mind that the developed world, the U.S. especially, has still lots and lots of utilization, lots and lots of aggregate demand from which to pick up from. So while we are seeing commodities move here, and we saw a move from 01 to 07 and 08, as you mentioned, I think similar to the generation bull run in interest rates, the generation bear run in commodity prices that ran through 01 or 02 and seen that bottom, we seem to be, you know, continuing that general uptrend over the past 6 or 8 years, due in part to supply and demand, but also fed more recently by inflation concerns.
If oil today was at $175 a barrel, it would be the talk of the town.
Yeah.
The notable in recent weeks has been silver at a 31-year high and gold also closing at an all-time high. You know, it seems that it's lightly discussed, and I'm wondering if the public conversation about gold is something like Eeyore showing up at a cocktail party. Nobody really enjoys the negativity. What does the price of precious metals imply?
Right.
Is that perhaps why the Financial Times, The Economist, other notable news venues remain somewhat dismissive of the metal? Is it just kind of a downer?
You have hit the head of the pick in the gold mine, I guess it were, David. I think you're absolutely right. The implications of the rise in gold prices, just as the implications of the drop in gold prices that we saw throughout the 80s and 90s will continue to be debated. But the fact is, holding a mirror up to that rise in the gold price, especially in silver as well, portends concerns about monetary inflation, concerns about geopolitical risks, no doubt about it, and real worries about the value of the currency, of the paper currencies that the world has embraced over the last generation and a half. And so none of those things are real happy-go-lucky conversation starters, no doubt about it.
It seems there's a little bit of a disconnect between the stated inflation rate and the implied understanding of inflation by the guy in the street. If you go back to the Summers-Barsky thesis, Gibson's paradox in the Summers-Barsky thesis, Larry Summers basically writes that in a negative real rate environment, that's when people opt to take risk off the table and move to precious metals. That tends to outperform in a negative or low real rate environment. You know, but if you look at the official numbers, we are not in a negative real rate environment. We have really tame inflation. The cost of living adjustment has not been raised the last 2 years, signaling that CPI and inflation doesn't exist. And yet the man on the street says, I'm wondering if that's balderdash.
Right. They use stronger language than that, by the way.
Yeah, of course. So this is an issue. I mean, we do have a drive towards the metals as a preservation tactic. We saw QE1 come around. Mortgage-backed securities were the primary effort there, and that was deemed acceptable by the U.S. and international market. So then you have QE2, and the market has judged that intervention in the Treasury sector unacceptable. You've had yields which have moved aggressively higher since its announcement, the opposite of what was intended. This is an issue. QE2, monetization, quantitative easing, these concepts all wrapped up in one spell inflation to somebody. You know, we certainly have seen a move by your David Einhorns and John Paulsons into the metals as a currency position, not a commodity. So, I mean, transitioning from our original conversation about commodities, supply and demand, inflation impacting gold and silver, we actually have a number of fairly significant investors saying, I'm just looking for an opt-out. I'm just looking for a currency that's not tied into the fiat world of either the euro, the British pound, the dollar, or whatnot, where monetary policymakers are going to determine my ultimate outcome of success or failure. What do you see with QE2? Do we carry that through to June? Do they cancel it because inflation becomes a concern? Is QE3, you know, even an option?
You know, Ben Bernanke last week when he was on Capitol Hill as part of his semiannual testimony was asked just that question about QE3 by a congressman, and he essentially ducked the answer by saying that would be a decision by the Federal Open Market Committee. Well, that's clearly a firm grasp of the obvious, but not really an answer to the question, Mr. Chairman. I think that the Federal Reserve is being more transparent now about its ultimate strategies than it ever has been, and part of that's because the market is still on tender hooks, still very sensitive. Certainly the interest rate market is, let alone the metals market and the equity markets and real estate all tied in here together. other. And I think that the Federal Reserve has drawn this line in the sand about June winding up its quantitative easing 2 program about buying U.S. government bonds. Should the Fed decide that the goal of that program needs to be retained or needs to be or hasn't been met and needs to continue, I think we would begin hearing some talk about that from the Federal Reserve regional presidents, let alone the Board of Governors and speeches and elsewhere, really now to get the market prepared for that. We haven't been hearing that. Instead, what we've been hearing is quite the opposite, that Federal Open Market Committee members seem to be more and more in tune, that they are going to stick to their guns, that they're going to continue with this quantitative easing program until it is due to expire. And at that point, they will begin to assess the relative success or not. But let's not kid ourselves here, David. The Fed is assessing the success and failure of this program on a daily basis and clearly on a monthly basis. They need to see unemployment rates come down and the real unemployment rates, not talking about the 9% that we see printed almost every month. We need to see the real unemployment rate go down, the U5, the U6 numbers. We need to see jobless claims continue to move lower. And they'd love to see inflation, the official number, begin to tick up. And to your earlier point about the man on the street and the woman on the street, their real inflation, all of our real inflation does continue to pick up. There's a program called the Billion Prices Project at MIT. It's bpp.mit.edu. And this follows hundreds of thousands of products that are sold online in many different countries. And you can drill down to specific geographical locations. And over the course of the past couple of years, David, it's seen to be a leading indicator to the CPI, and it is beginning to go parabolic. And that becomes, I think, a big concern for the Fed. But does inflation become a bigger concern than unemployment? I honestly don't think so. I think the bigger concern is unemployment than price stability at this point.
Well, it seems like we're in that classic stagflation scenario. It is interesting, though, coming back to the interest rate environment, because with record, really unprecedented funding requirements, you have rollover risk in the Treasury market on top of current deficit spending. $1 trillion was projected by the CBO. It ends up at $1.65 trillion for this year, top of $1.5 trillion last year. Maybe they can rein in on spending. Maybe there's cuts. But the reality is we have both the rollover of existing debt with new debt being piled on.
Yep.
It seems a safe assumption to see rates going higher. Now, that's not to say moving parabolic, but, you know, certainly an adjustment higher, if nothing else, because of those market constraints.
Yeah. And I think let me add, you know, kind of a macro concern on top of the accounting that you talk about from the federal government level. You know, for generations, the U.S. essentially has been able to grow itself out of these really awful debt to GDP ratios. We're beginning to hear continued talk about, you know, the U.S. needs to grow at 3.5 or 4, maybe 4.5% to really begin to make a dent here. But at what point are we going to have a realization on the part of our federal government and voters, for that matter, that, you know, a 2.5, even a 3 or 3.2% annual GDP growth may not be enough in order for us to grow our way out of this debt to GDP ratio, let alone begin to work down that debt load that we've incurred over the past 60 years.
Well, we'll tune in tonight to listen to the PBS Nightly Business Report with great interest. The only thing we haven't discussed, and maybe we can end with this, is, you know, there seems to me to be a difference between commercial broadcasters and what you do with PBS. And maybe it's just the nature of why commercial broadcasting exists. What is their reason for existence versus the venue that you professionally participate in? Is there a different tack taken because of the audience constraints and sort of business model?
Well, yes, there is. There absolutely is a difference in the business model, and there's a big difference in our audience. And, you know, what we have the privilege of being able to be on the air in millions of homes every night and have essentially a half hour to tell the story of business, finance, and money to America each night. You know, some of my colleagues in financial broadcasting journalism have 8 hours to fill, have 12 hours to fill, and it becomes much more of a kind of a play-by-play and much more of a focus on the box score scenario than what we're able to do with Nightly Business Report, which is clearly always keeping our eye on the prices to wind up our conversation where we began it, David. Price action does matter, but we're able to distill out of that, hopefully, some larger trends in how some of these policy discussions that are going on in the nation's capital and in state capitals wind up impacting either the paycheck that you receive or the prices that you're seeing at the store or the portfolio that you have to save for tomorrow.
Tom, thanks for joining us. Great to be in touch with you again. Look forward to it in the future, and we look forward to your insights nightly.
It's been really my pleasure, David. I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Tom Hudson. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or call us anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.